Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, June 17th, 2022. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble's got its finger on the beat of the issues that matter to you. If you're curious about the latest news in Canadian politics, labor, environment, or social justice, you've come to the right place to find the stories that matter to you, free of corporate influence. This week on Rabble Radio, Libby Davies sits down with Liz Marshall, the writer, director, and producer of the recently internationally released documentary, Meet the Future. Meet the Future tells the story of Dr. Uma Valetti, the co-founder and CEO of Upside Down Foods, the leading startup of the cultivated, or clean, as it's sometimes called, meat revolution. Marshall sits down with Davies to talk about the film and the powerful impact clean meat can have on agriculture and the climate emergency. Marshall last joined Rabble Radio to talk with Victoria Fenner about the documentary during our Climate Hope in the Time of Pandemic series. At that point, the film had just been released. Now, with a global audience, Marshall explains the global response the film has received from policymakers and filmgoers alike. Liz Marshall is an award-winning Canadian filmmaker. Mixing character-driven cinematic storytelling with social and environmental justice issues, Marshall has created a large body of work since her introduction to the documentary filmmaking world in the 1990s. Marshall's work focuses on a wide range of subjects, including animal rights, the right to water movement, sweatshop labor, corporate globalization, and more. Libby Davies is a longtime Vancouver activist, city councillor, and former deputy leader and house leader of the federal NDP, representing the riding of Vancouver East from 1997 to 2015. Davies is also a member of the Order of Canada and author of Outside In, a political memoir. Here are Marshall and Davies in conversation. Take a listen.
Liz, you are the writer, director, and producer of Meet the Future, most recently released internationally in early April of this year. It's an absolutely fascinating documentary about cultivated meat, or clean meat as it's sometimes called, and the powerful impact it can have on agriculture and the climate emergency. I was checking out your website, and in your director statement, you say, quote, "What the future holds for cultivated meat is unclear, but I believe its revolutionary journey into the world will stand the test of time," end of quote. So to begin, Liz, how is the revolution going?
The revolution has been documented. So Meet the Future is a film that I had the privilege of following a story over several years from behind the scenes of the birth of a new industry, a new idea, a new movement, a new way of thinking and seeing and doing things when it comes to meat production. And this is not, you know, plant-based or synthetic, as some people call it, frankenfood. I think there's a lot of misconceptions out there. You know, there's a lot of fear around food and technology. But when we take a giant step back and we look at the history of food, and certainly when we zero in and focus on conventional animal agriculture and how meat gets to the plate, we can see there are so many problems. And we are in the midst of several emergencies. So we've got the climate crisis, and we need solutions, and we need viable solutions. We don't need utopian aspiration, although that's important to dream of a world that is not based in capitalism, that's for sure. However, we live in capitalism, and we need to use those levers right now in a viable sense to lead us out and away from the mess that we're in. And so I was really interested as a storyteller to get that unique behind the scenes access as early as 2016, when I learned about the unveiling of the world's first cultivated meatball. And let me just back up and explain for listeners who are not familiar with what this next agricultural revolution is. So it's a new food science, and it's now referred to in a variety of different terms. Like an umbrella term would be cellular agriculture, which is fascinating. And the industry worldwide, which is still in its infancy, has adopted, and everyone's now referring to it as cultivated meat or cultivated seafood. But it's harvesting cells from animal tissue to enable the growth of meat, fish, seafood, dairy, and eggs as a solution to raising and slaughtering billions and billions of animals every year, which is somewhere between 70 and 100 billion per year. And that doesn't include the trillions of fish life in our oceans. So we know that current modes of production are totally unsustainable. The facts are in. We don't even need to talk about that or dispute that. Like, we need solutions, and the world's not going vegan. Although there is a trend and an upward consciousness and behavioral shift that's taking place where people are eating more plant-based proteins. That's good. That's really good. So anyways, I could go on and on. I mean, when you are a documentary filmmaker who immerses yourself over time in a subject, you become like a small E expert. The film is quite measured. It's not polemical. It's certainly not propaganda. It's really an inside look at the birth of something that could really change the way we think about food.
So I'd like to bring you back to a more personal question, because I know that you're a vegan. So are people surprised that you support cultivated meat? Like, how do those two worlds jive together?
Well, I'm an ethical vegan, which means I choose to not eat animals because I don't want to support the systems of what's involved in animal cruelty. And I'm also an environmentalist, so I don't want to support these systems that contribute so much in the way of greenhouse gas emissions, you know, biodiversity loss, land and water use, all of these things. And so for me as an activist, it's a daily way of being an activist. And I see the issue as an activist, not just about animals, it's about human health, it's about human rights, and it's also about environmental sanity. So for me, you know, back in 2016, I was really looking for a solution-focused story that could be character-driven and something that we could follow over time. So it was unfolding. And I found it. I think I could sort of hang my hat on, wow, this is really unprecedented. And so that was my motivation.
Well, you certainly found the story. I was very interested that on your website, you host a flagship of series of panel discussions with some very interesting people and experts who really get into the history and the origins of cultivated meat and what the future holds. And you just said earlier that the facts are in and we don't need to dispute that. And I would totally agree with that. But it does lead me to a question of what are the impediments to a clean meat future, because there's legal issues, there's political issues, there's massive lobby issues in terms of the agricultural business as we know it. So what are the impediments that you see to a clean meat future?
I think there's definitely some hurdles, obviously. And one of the biggest ones, I think, is the scalability. You know, the startups around the globe, and there's over 100 now, all over the globe, that are laser focused on this food science. I think the next great hurdle and leap is it scalable en masse in a way that can be accessible, affordable to people everywhere, and for it not to be just a niche product? Because we know it is coming to market. So for example, Singapore is the first country in the world to have regulated it. Wow. So it's available for consumers there for over a year and a half now. And the US is well on its way to bringing this to market. And that's part of what the film follows, is that food regulatory pathway and those nuances and complexities. And that was a tricky thing to follow in a film, because you don't want it to be too boring or inside baseball. And so, you know, trying to unpack these big ideas and then follow food regulatory issues in a documentary while making the documentary accessible was a great task. So the FDA and the USDA are working together on this, and all indicators suggest that, you know, it will be on the market soon. So I think the short answer is it's not a question of if, it's a question of when. And I think the hurdles around scalability will probably be the greatest sort of question mark, and we'll see.
As with other questions on the climate crisis, there's a very big question and challenge in terms of transition from an unsustainable economy that's destroying us and the planet to an economy that is clean and sustainable. I can imagine that the vested interests in the existing agricultural industry are just so massive and powerful. Do you foresee that this change will begin to pick up speed, or is it going to just be a struggle every step of the way, as just like with the oil and gas and fossil fuel industry, you know, they try to do a U-turn, they try to come up with new arguments, and it makes that dramatic change that's needed very, very challenging. And I imagine it will be the same here.
It's a good analogy, and that's exactly how I would see it as well. And I think that the challenges, you know, and the struggles are already there. You know, there's a big struggle around what the labeling should be. You know, the cultivated meat producers want this to be referred to as meat because it is meat. At the cellular level, there's no difference. It's exactly the same. It's identical. What is different is how it gets there. So it's a very cumbersome process to produce conventional meat. And then the meat producers of cultivated food is totally radically different. And that's the difference. So there's a big struggle right now, and it's illustrated in the film around labeling. That sounds minor, but it's big. And so I think an interesting twist and turn in the story was, like, year two of following this story, two of the largest meat producers in the world invested in the teeny tiny startup company that we had access to film over time. So Cargill and Tyson. And so there's more investments that have been made globally by the meat industry into this new way of producing meat. And I think that poses all kinds of questions. And I think the biggest question is, you know, why would the cultivated meat producers accept that kind of investment and partnership? And I think the answer is simple. And certainly the protagonist of Meet the Future, Dr. Uma Valetti, is kind of a masterful diplomat who wants everyone under the tent and wants to work with all stakeholders to create this transformative way of doing things rather than creating a disruption or a disruptive technology that's on the side and marginalized. Is that when you look at just how giant these food systems are and how global it all is, the systemic mechanism, it needs to integrate this new way of doing things rather than starting from scratch. So that's why the word transformation of, you know, a paradigm shift is more interesting, certainly to me as a storyteller, rather than disruption.
What does it mean in terms of the labor market and employment?
I think that that's also a great question that's not necessarily touched on as much in the film. That would kind of be maybe the next film that someone makes when it actually does get to market, and you can look more deeply into the ecosystems that this new food system is part of, and that is, it's creating jobs, new ways of doing things. Certainly, it means phasing out a certain way of doing things, like coal. We know that coal needs to phase out completely in the world. Well, conventional agriculture needs industrial animal agriculture, which, by the way, is 99% of how meat gets to the plate. It's only that 1% that's very niche, expensive, you know, and elite, that is a different method. But it's that 99% of meat production that is industrial, large-scale animal production. That's the system that needs to be phased out.
it's not only a huge question environmentally in terms of the climate crisis and the fact that it is a solution, but the economic questions and transformation is also quite massive. And I was thinking, you know, when we think of Canada, you know, and places like Alberta and beef production, how does it play out in Canada? And that sort of leads me to my next question, is that if people who view this film and read about the issue accept the challenges that you lay out in Meet the Future, what are some of the next steps that any of us could take, particularly here in Canada?
I think that there has to be political will. And I love that you're such an influential politician that I'm having this discussion with, because that, you know, in the States, there is political will. You know, I think here there is as well, but there needs to be lobbying for this shift to take place and innovative funding and research that is public and not just privatized. You know, there's an enormous amount of subsidies that government gives to conventional animal agriculture. Well, that needs to stop, you know, or it needs to shift. And there needs to be more research and development money that goes towards the development of alternative proteins. And I know that Trudeau's government has actually done a bit of that, not towards cellular agriculture, but towards plant-based agriculture, which is great. And there needs to be a lot more of that. People focus, you know, when they're talking about climate, when they're talking about the climate emergency, there's an enormous amount of focus, especially right now, on gas and oil. And that's correct. But meat and dairy production is the third leading cause of climate change. And we can't continue to ignore it. It's like an inconvenient truth.
So for sure, the activist community here within Canada needs to embrace this and shift the focus to include cellular structure protein alternatives. I mean, my sense is that it's not yet on the radar in a really big way, but so it's very much sort of baby steps. So I think obviously your film is a great catalyst to open up that discussion.
Yes,
and to make people aware.
That's the purpose of the film. And I think that, you know, we can hang our hat on that being a truth, you know, that the film is the first and only feature-length documentary in the world about the birth of this industry, about this big, huge idea. And it's so great that Canada's Documentary Channel commissioned it and supported it. People can watch the film in Canada on CBC Gem for free. And then the international version, which was just released as part of Earth Month, available in the US and select territories around the world, is available on Apple TV and Amazon and other platforms like that. People can follow us at meetthefuture.com and learn more.
And you're off to Toronto to the Hot Dogs Festival, which is awesome. So I know you're getting a lot of coverage and you're doing a lot of discussion, which is great. What has the reception been like when people have seen the film? You've had wonderful critical reviews. What's the audience reception been like? Are you able to gauge that at all?
Yeah, I think it's been because we've had a tiered release. So the film was released in 2020 as part of the Hot Docs Film Festival, and then on CBC Gem, you know, and then it's been around the world at amazing film festivals. And then it was repackaged several months ago with Dr. Jane Goodall as the narrator and Moby as my exec producer, and his music is in the film now. So that's the international version. So it's been a really interesting journey of 6 years on this project. And I would say the audience response is varied. So there's a lot of passionate response, you know, people who feel that, you know, the film has achieved its goal of opening hearts and minds to see what this is and to, you know, imagine, you know, a humane food system that's climate smart. That's what we need to do. That's what a good documentary, I think, needs to trigger for people, is new ways of thinking and seeing and imagining and fostering conversation. So I hope it continues to do that. And that's certainly our goal.
Well, it's a brilliant film. I think you're a wonderful spokesperson on this issue because you're very clear and informative about what needs to happen. So I want to thank you so much for joining me today with just a brief conversation about the film. And I know that it's going to have a very broad audience and more people will be talking about this issue. And I'm very interested. It might have to come back to you one day and do another interview about how it's all playing out in the Canadian political scene as we take on that Alberta beef industry, for example. So yeah, thank you so much, Liz.
Thank you, Libby. It's an honor to talk to you.
That was Libby Davies in conversation with Liz Marshall, director of the international feature-length documentary Meet the Future. Thanks so much for that, Libby and Liz. Now it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, I'll hand it over to the editor of Rabble.ca, Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week, Rabble.ca shared an op-ed from Leah Gazan, MP for Winnipeg Centre. Gazan wonders, when will the federal government consider real justice for Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people? In Canada, Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples are 12 times more likely to go missing or be murdered than any other population across the country. And yet, despite all this, the government has made next to no progress on the National Action Plan that was introduced a year ago. This is a devastating blow, especially considering that missing murdered Indigenous women and girls also received no mention in the federal budget this year. By refusing to act, the government is telling Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people that we have zero value, Gazan writes. I am tired of listening to the million excuses that seem to justify inaction as if our safety is of no relevance. Now's the time to stop making excuses and give us the justice we deserve. It is time to end this crisis of violence and genocide now. Also on the site this week, guest writer Lila Galipo shared her personal story of terminating her pregnancy during her first year of university. Despite knowing that it was the right choice for her to make, Galipo writes that she struggled with the decision because of the stigma towards people who receive abortions and her grandfather's legacy as a federal conservative MP and stringent anti-choice activist. I hope to destigmatize abortion in a neutral way, Galipo writes. When issues are so polarizing, it's easy to get emotional, but we don't need emotionally fueled conversations. We need the right to basic health care. Also this week, the City of Toronto has spent significant amounts of money on their shelter system, but those funds seem to have gone towards subsidizing hotels rather than paying for things like good meals for those in need, observes Kathy Crow in her most recent column. Crow writes that a report by Toronto's Auditor General Beverly Romero Beeler that was presented to the city's audit committee on June 6 details financial faults with the city's contracts for shelter hotels for the homeless. The report calculates that overpayments could have provided about 52,000 room nights, meals, and wraparound services for an entire year. Instead, 216 homeless people died last year in Toronto. In Canadian politics, a historic anti-racism data law took effect in British Columbia on Friday, June 10th, which aims at promoting equity and combating racism. Stephen Wenzel reports that the Anti-Racism Data Act requires the provincial government to collect intersectional demographic data such as age, gender identity, and ethnic origin. The goal of the legislation is to better identify issues like economic inequality, employment statistics, and healthcare outcomes. The legislation is based on feedback from more than 13,000 British Columbians. The government also awarded grants to about 70 Indigenous and racialized community organizations to go towards community engagement sessions on the Anti-Racism Data Act. Organizations which were part of the consultations for the act hope the legislation will help advance other anti-racism initiatives across the country. Contributor Doreen Nickel covered the launch of the Toxic Hush campaign this week. The Toxic Hush campaign shares the stories of women who have experienced harassment online. The campaign also seeks to put pressure on tech companies, particularly social media platforms, to do better in policing toxic users and harassment on their sites. Toxic Hush is organized by Informed Opinions, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting and promoting the speech of women and gender-diverse people. Brandy Morin is a French, Cree, and Iroquois journalist from Treaty 6 Alberta. She has thousands of followers on Twitter and Instagram and shared her experience of the first time she received a death threat online through her email. The threat was sent by someone using a pseudonym. The violent, graphic threat also included very personal details about Morin's life. She contacted the police but was told they couldn't do anything until the situation escalated. They did recommend Morin lock her doors. Informed Opinions encourages women across Canada to make their voices heard by completing the Toxic Hush survey. The results will undoubtedly paint an evidence-based picture too powerful to be ignored by government or social media corporations. Finally, it's Pride Month. Rabble Labour reporter Gabriela Kaluge-Kasuga reports on Pride at Work Canada's efforts to promote inclusivity in the workplace. As a part of this campaign, Pride at Work held a workshop on Wednesday, January 15th, titled Supporting 2S LGBTQIA Plus Resurgence Beyond Performative Allyship, to discuss concrete ways to promote workplace inclusivity. Allyship is about building a better workplace together, explained panelist Corinne Mirgiani Jean-Francois, a planning advisor for Gender-Based Analysis Plus. Salish Wesley, an educator and knowledge keeper who also participated in the panel, said that many people get defensive when these tasks are presented to them. Some may not be prepared to acknowledge their privilege. We need to get past that defensiveness and realize there's a beautiful destination ahead, Wesley said. A report released by Pride at Work in January of 2021 showed that 2S LGBTQIA+ Canadians were more likely to be paid less than their heterosexual counterparts and were more likely to experience mental health issues. Jean-Francois explained that creating a more inclusive workplace is possible through effort and an open-minded approach. You need to be open and thoughtful and ready to unlearn some things, Jean-Francois said. You can catch all of those stories and much, much more on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. Hey, Rabble Radio listeners, have you considered supporting our show? If you haven't been part of the community that keeps Rabble thriving yet, please consider joining at any level. Becoming a monthly supporter from $3 and up will help Rabble keep delivering the quality independent journalism you're used to 365 days a year. Rabble.ca has never had a paywall or charged a subscription fee, and the generous support of our readers and listeners ensures that Rabble's progressive news and views remain corporate-free and accessible to all. That's what media democracy's made of. Visit rabble.ca/donate to learn more. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble, but it means so much. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. If you have feedback for the show, ideas, stories, opinions you'd like us to cover, we'd love to hear about it. Get in touch with us anytime at editor@rabble.ca. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. And thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. Shout out to the listeners at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario this week. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.